It's music from After the Chase. The song is called Holy Healer. 12 and a half minutes after the hour here. It's a Monday here along the Broken Road. I'm Jim Park, and let's see, Heike Dodge is with us. Heike, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
And David Adelpunt, of course, in the newsroom, and we're joined now by Don Clark from Garden Valley, Texas, out in East Texas, where the wind is blowing today, isn't it, Don?
I don't think it's blowing yet, but it will.
Oh, supposed to, yeah. You had high wind warnings on the weather forecast today, so I'm just thinking you have to be out there holding on to your grapes.
Oh, it's really frustrating because when the wind blows, if you try to tie them up, it's just really difficult because they're kind of flapping in the breeze.
Yeah.
And earlier this year, we got a lot of wind damage. Some of the young vines, new shoots were just breaking off in the wind.
No.
And that's discouraging.
That'd be upsetting. Dr. Don is a biochemist. He's a board member with Creation Moments. And also, what's the word again, David, for raising, when you raise grapes? You don't make wine necessarily, but you're a grape
beer.
Well,
the vigneron?
Vigneron.
Yeah. Vigneron.
Okay.
Grape manager.
Means grape farmer.
Vineyard manager.
Yeah. You don't, for some reason, you don't call a one who raises grapes a grape farmer, do you? I mean, you could be a corn farmer, you could be a wheat farmer, but you're not a grape farmer.
Well, you are a wine grower.
Ah. Okay. I like that.
That puts you up a level, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not just grapes.
That's true.
You're actually growing wine because the quality of wine starts with being able to manage your grapes properly. And so far, we haven't been able to do that.
Yeah, well, it's coming along. I mean, in Texas, you know, it's an uphill fight, isn't it, for wine growers? Or is the wine business booming in Texas now?
Oh, no, it's definitely the wine business is booming.
Uh-huh.
I was at a symposium, I guess it was a week or two ago, and we have a varietal of grape called Blanc du Bois, and that's a white grape, and it has a very nice bouquet and flavor to it, and it can... really compete with a lot of the other white wines in the world, but people don't know about what's a Blanc du Bois.
Uh-huh.
And it's American varietal, grows very, very well here in Texas, and actually it would grow well along the south, the Gulf states as well. It was originally developed in Florida and by a fellow from the University of Florida, and you can do a lot of things with it, and it's just has a nice flavor. Texas is now the world's greatest producer of Blanc du Bois, and that's one of the varieties that we have.
You just need a little promotion, then, is what you need.
We do. We do need a promotion, and then some comparison tests. So.
Blanc du Bois. It sounds like a character at a Yancey Derringer show, you know.
The fellow who developed it, his name was Dubois, and that's where the Blanc du Bois comes from. So
that would be of what would Dubois mean? David, you're our French expert. What does that mean? Dubois.
I don't know.
Means of some place, maybe? Is there a place called Bois?
Well, it's actually if you literally translate it would be white wood. But the bark isn't white, so doing digging, it was just happened to be the guy's name who developed it.
All right, well, it works for me. I think that's
I would imagine somebody would present a wine called Blanche Dubois, wouldn't you think?
White,
it's a Blanc,
white. Yeah.
It's a Blanc Dubois, but they call it Blanche. I mean, that's how does it compare to a Riesling or a Sauvignon Blanc?
It tastes very much like a Riesling, actually.
Really?
I tried it. I said, wow, this is a Riesling.
Mm-hmm.
And there's different wineries have produced everything from a very dry, acidic, white to very, very sweet. Wines to rosés to even ports with it, so you can do a lot with it.
Yeah.
Well, and that's one of the Riesling's hallmarks as well. I mean, the German wine manufacturing organization has for its high class wines has six different levels of sweetness, from absolute bone dry to dessert wines, and it's all Riesling, and it's all it's all Vigneron, and it's all the stuff that goes on in the winery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the same grapes. You can do that with this grape. So
interesting.
I'm looking forward to trying my hand at making some wine from it.
Yeah, hi,
do you know offhand anybody who would distribute a version of that would be distributed up in this neck of the woods?
I don't think anybody here in Texas is exporting a whole lot as yet.
Mm.
We've got some folks coming in from and buying Texas wine like crazy.
Mm.
But I don't know if any of the wineries have the licenses to export. I mean, right now, the wine industry is young enough that the tourism is buying up all the wine.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So
they've never seen anything like a Texas wine. Hey, we got to bring a bottle of this home. Show the folks. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there is a Blanc de Bois buy online, and it's there's a company called Snooth, Snoooth, that allows purchases online.
I took a wrong turn here because I mentioned an area of discussion that David has some expertise in, and he took the ball and he ran with it right down the center line.
We wouldn't want that, would we?
Oh yes, absolutely not. I mean, we certainly
wouldn't want to talk about something that Dave knows something about.
Well, of course every now and then we stumble on something that David can deal
it
with.
It happens every once in a while.
Yeah, that's nice.
You know, like once a month.
Well, how does young Earth creationism appeal to you, David?
I've got a short description about Blanc de Bois, one of the Florissant Syrah. It's not dissimilar to Muscat.
He's in the fast lane now, Heike. We're in trouble. Mm-hmm.
And then this particular website also refers to it as a Riesling-like still, and there are sparkling wines that are made from it as well. Okay, I'm done now.
Okay, that's a wrap.
Well, let's start back later on, Don.
We needed to get the word out about Blanc de Bois. Now we've got the listening audience clamoring
word
for
is
this
all
wine.
Circulating in the cloud today. People are going, what, if it's Texas wine? Nah, I don't believe it. And then they'll tune in for the facts. We come to you for facts because you're a scientist. I mean, you know the scientific method. You've worked in the scientific fields. And here we have a survey, which is... Actually, and this was on biologos.com, biologos.org the other day. It's a survey of clergy and their view on origins and really asking what pastors think about science. And it was a survey done in 2012, 743 telephone interviews with pastors all across from the U.S., big and small churches and from all denominations. And they gave us a chart here. By the way, it was when we post the conversation later today, I'll give you a link to this, but it's biologos.org. You could just say creation and evolution and search for it. Find it on the site, I'm sure. But there's a graph here that says 35% of U.S. Protestant pastors believe in young earth creation. And do you find that number surprising, either one way or the other? Done?
Oh, actually, the percentage is higher than that because you have it's broken down into two categories. One is core, that is, they believe in young earth creationism, and there's no conflict about it. And then there's 35% who are learning about young earth creationism or who are leaning towards young earth creationism and have not apparently. Firmed up that, that's exactly the way God created things. So if you really look at the total number, that's 54% of pastors that, if not believe completely, are leaning towards that way.
Is there anything surprising in that to you?
Well, it's...
Is it higher or lower than you would have expected?
Oh no, it's about what I would expect. I also looked online, looking at what percentage of the general population believes in young Earth creationism, and that number surprisingly is 46%, and hasn't really changed over probably 50 years or so. since 1982, at least when the survey was first conducted. This is a Gallup poll survey, which can be found on Gallup's Gallup.com's site. They say that 46% of the general population believes in young Earth creationism, and 32%, an additional 32% believe that God directed, at least we would call them theistic evolutionists, God directed the origins or evolution of man.
But it might have taken a much longer period and used other processes than the young Earth creationists would contend.
That's correct.
Mm. Okay. And then there's kind of middle ground. I'm wondering here, and this is a loaded question, I know, but who has more credibility, science or the Bible, with modern-day Americans?
Well, that is a loaded question, and I don't know if I can answer that. it depends on your, I guess, your point of view, because they do ask kind of a similar question in this survey, and we've talked about it before. I don't think those two are exclusive, but they should be mutually inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about it, if you did not believe in a God, if you did not believe in order, then how can you do science? Because in order to conduct science, in order to do science, you have to, you know, first believe that you can repeat your experiment. If you could never repeat your experiment, you would have nothing to talk about. And you would never make you would never be able to put together a hypothesis and a theory, and which then would become a law after it's been tried over and over and over and over again. So even those folks that say, "Oh, we're atheists, we are doing just in quote pure science," are kind of fooling themselves, because they must believe that the universe is ordered before they could do anything.
You know, that observation is really incisive, because if you think from a pure science, a pure humanistic viewpoint, if science looks at the universe and says, this is chaotic, there is no order, they might as well quit there.
Exactly. There's nothing to talk about. Because
except that, the tendency is to invent something to explain it. I mean, they're assigned the task of coming up with answers. They can't just throw their hands up and say, well, we're just not going to deal with it because there's no way to figure this out. They'll invent something and then modify it year after year or generation after generation to conform with the facts that they can see. And isn't that how evolution came to be?
Well, it was. I mean, Darwin obviously was the one who popularized evolution. With his study of the finches on Galapagos Island, which is a story in itself. But, the interesting thing about science is you observe the world, and what you see is order, and so therefore you say, well, I should be able to explain this in some way. And the only way that an atheist gets around this is to say, well, everything started to nothing, everything was chaotic at the beginning, but somehow order came out of chaos, and we call those the physical laws that we can observe today.
Really kind of a grand assumption, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it's also kind of admitting that, okay, well, there is order in the world. And where did the order come from? If everything was chaotic, where did the order come from? And, even in the simplest terms, and this is just a silly example, but even in the simplest terms, you take a child and you put him in a room, and there's toys in the room, and the toys are nicely lined up on the shelves. It doesn't take him long, or her, but it's probably, let's use a guy, because we're more inclined to destroy the room. It doesn't take the little boy long to completely go through all the toys, and they're no longer on the shelves. They're no longer in order. They're spread out, you know, throughout the available playing area, and so chaos has entered the room. Now, it takes energy and it takes intelligence to put those toys back. It's not just a matter of, well, those toys are going to go back. You know, if we allow the child to play with them long enough, they're going to go back onto the shelves. And that, as we know, never happens.
It's kind of like the monkeys with typewriters, or the chimpanzees with typewriters. If you gave enough chimpanzees typewriters, eventually it would write all the works of Shakespeare.
And well, that's the story that they give us, and of course that would never happen either.
Someone would come up with "to be or not to be." That is the Gazornenblattrinden, and they'd have to put that monkey to the side, I think.
Earmark him for something great.
Yeah.
Like winemaking.
I'm thinking of the earliest, like winemaking. Uh-oh. Here's an off-ramp approaching, I can see. I see a couple of primitive guys on a hillside watching the stars go round, day after day, night after night, year after year, and suddenly one of them says, "Hey, I've seen this before. I remember this. It was 365 days ago. On this night, the stars were in the same position." Might that have been the first inkling of order? I mean, because and the first conclusion would have been, I think, someone planned it that way.
Yeah. Well, you can look at that and suppose that, and without a knowledge of God and God telling us how things were put together from the very beginning, one could you know, look up in the sky and say, well, gee, yes, there's order to it. Even every night, you don't have to wait a whole year. You can say every night, those dots, those bright lights in the sky, are in the same configuration, and they've been in the same configuration, you know, since I've been born. And so, what are those things, and why do they move? And then you can start the process of saying, okay, obviously something is spinning, and then you can figure out, well, you know, the Earth is stationary and everything else is spinning, or the Earth is spinning and you know, the stars are stationary relative to the Earth, or a combination of both.
But they would have drawn the conclusion that there is some kind of order here.
The Bible speaks to this, because the Bible says the heavens declare the glory of God. And so we should be able to look out into the vastness of space. And now we have the ability of the Hubble telescope and deep space telescopes that are finding all kinds of interesting and wonderful and glorious things. And we should be able to say, wow, you know, isn't God, you know, glorious? Isn't his creation glorious? But, you know, we don't necessarily say that.
And the scientists then come along after these two folks have observed the sky for endless eons, and they say, well, those stars, you call them, those points of light, are actually huge balls of flaming gas scattered bazillions of miles from here, one in orbit around another, and there are galaxies and nebula, and it's really a pretty messy picture. So it looks chaotic, and yet, from our standpoint here on Earth, we're not interpolating. There's a word. We're drawing out order. We're seeing order in this, by which we can plan things like crops. You know, it makes sense to us to see it in a certain way, and we can use that information. That itself, to me, is a miracle. They could look at these points of light without really understanding. They don't need to know that they're burning orbs millions of miles away. All they need to know is what time it is to plant the wheat.
Right, and certain civilizations have built, ground observation stations, basically, to be able to predict when certain events would happen. or to be able to say that, okay, now it's time to plant crops, or now it's time to do this in our worship of the Creator, mm-hmm. or whatever it happens to be. And that came long before Galileo, invented the telescope. Mm-hmm. Galileo was the one who observed other planets and observed moons with the telescope. You can then, even see more order to the universe than what you could see with the naked eye.
Is science an asset?
I think it should be an asset. with the right mindset, that everything that we explore, and God gave us, remember that we are made in the image of God, so we have the ability to create. Now, we can't create from nothing like God can, but we have the ability to create, we have the ability to think, we have the ability to figure things out, and those are all attributes of God that's in our character. And so to be able to observe the universe around us, whether it be through a microscope or up in the heavens, or even the world, around us from a geological point of view, and then draw conclusions, we should have in the back of our mind this notion that God created it all, and we're just trying to understand the world that we live in. So it should not be exclusive, it should be inclusive, and I think we would do better science, not worse science, as some would have you believe, that you can't be a scientist if you believe in God, and especially if you believe in a young earth creation, because clearly the evidence is on old age of not only our universe, but our earth. And if you believe in young earth creation, then you can't be a good scientist. Well, that's the furthest thing from the truth. Mm-hmm. You can be a better scientist if you understand, using what the Bible has given us to help explain the world around us.
There is a part of the survey, it's the 12% segment on the chart that says uncertain. That is, these pastors believe that God created life, but they admit they are not certain how. I'm thinking, if you're a pastor, you must accept the premise that there is a God. I mean, that's kind of a given, and you're there to serve Him, but then you don't take His word for it. You discount the Bible. We're kind of separating the Bible from God. That is, they are, I think, that there's a division there. There's a distrust, a notion that it's maybe folklore and fantasy or tradition or somehow has been corrupted over time. How do we correct that? Can science help us in getting back to the original version, for example? I mean, word one.
believing Genesis 1. Science can help us, and actually, Institute of Creation Research (ICR) did a study some time back called the Rate Study, and I believe we talked about it before on this program. But one of the things that they did was, for example, look at the Hebrew verbs in Genesis 1 and compare it with other parts of the Bible. So. And the question was, are the verbs that are used in Genesis, are they poetic, like you have in the Psalms, or are they historical, like you have in Chronicles? And what they came out with, it was a stark difference between the two in the verb forms that were used, highly, highly on the historical perspective. So you can't just pass you would say, well, that's linguistic science, I suppose. I don't know what you would call that. But You can't just throw off that analysis and say, "Well, you know, that doesn't mean anything. It's poetic. It's that's the way it was written."
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if we call it historic, I think we're saying it's true. No, it happened just that way, as opposed to scientific truth, which can be a more exacting measuring stick, I suppose, in terms of how they analyze the language. Do we know when the book of Genesis was first written down?
Well, it was obviously, most of it was attributed to, at least the latter part of the book was attributed to Moses. The earlier part had to be, one of Adam's sons or descendants that first started to record it. And whether it was Moses who started writing things down from the very beginning, the story, if you will, and I hate to even use the word story, but the chronicle of mm-hmm. our origin, which would probably be a better description, was passed generation to generation. And as we've discussed, on this program, man had a tremendous ability to memorize things and to recite things. And so there was no need for the written language earlier on because we had this tremendous ability to remember. We were, God had created a perfect being in Adam and Eve. And their ability to, remember was tremendous, and that lasted, for quite a while. So it didn't, there was no need for the written language at that time. But the chronicle of how God made man, was passed on until it was finally written down.
Now, if memory serves me, and I'm certainly no expert in this, and this may be a better question or better be directed to an archaeologist, but when is the earliest evidence of writing? Doesn't it go back to about 3000 BC?
I don't know. You'd have to,
Okay, yeah, just curious. Because that whole development of symbolic, representation of a thought, an idea, a word, didn't come along in the beginning, and the notion that it didn't because we didn't need it is intriguing to me. I'd never even considered that. The mind of man was so sharp at one time, it didn't need reminders.
Well, it didn't need reminders, and even the Psalms were written in such a way that they were lyrical, obviously, mm-hmm. But it was also a mnemonic device. Sometimes it's easier to remember a song and its lyrics than it is just to, memorize a history book, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was also a mnemonic device that was used to pass on, type of information from one generation to the next.
Yeah, now, Heike, I don't know if we've acquainted you yet, but we've tagged Dr. Don as the developer of the theory of devolution. That, when in Adam's day, he was just incredibly bright compared to us. It has been downhill ever since because of sin.
Right. I have to say, I'm probably putting a target on myself for saying this, but these type of discussions, while they're interesting to me, they don't really affect my practical faith. They don't really affect how my relationship with God and with Christ. And they're fun topics to discuss with my children because, my children are all under 10, and so they want to know, why is the sky blue, and what makes rain, and these biblically science conversations are fun, but I'm not a scientist and I don't have the theory behind it. And at the end of the day, I still go back to the cross. And if God chose to create the world in a big bang in a moment, or if he chose to evolve it over time, if it was a 7-day creation or a 7,000 or 7 million year creation, I trust that he did the right thing, and it still takes me back to the cross.
Hmm. But you see, this kind of discussion. No, you haven't painted yourself with a target. I'm just saying, though, there are opponents out there who will tell you to your face that what you believe is just plain wrong, and it has been totally erased by modern science, who has proven otherwise. And some of us need to defend that position. And sometimes you can only defend a position by using the same kind of ammunition your attackers have. In other words, logic, rationale, or rational thinking. Because we can wave the Bible at them and say, read this, and they say, well, it's there's no credibility there.
I think that it's so much bigger than even we think our scientists can imagine, because we're talking about the entity who created time and created math, and our brains are so linear. You know, time for us is marked in a linear way. There's the beginning, there's the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing, and everything goes in one direction. But God invented time. He very possibly has been scrambling things up, and our little pea brains just can't wrap our wrap around the fact.
Well, sure,
that
now, yeah.
So I just, well, you know, go ahead.
I think that here is, you know, I guess the kind of the bottom line, at least on my thinking as to why this is an important, important discussion and topic. And of course, we've talked about creation and evolution and theistic evolution and those type of things. But it does boil down to the authenticity of the Bible. And if you have difficulty with the first chapter of the Bible, and difficulty meaning that you think this is it's a nice story, but it didn't really happen that way, then that can lead, not saying that it always does, but it can lead one to question other parts in the Bible. Jesus was quite adamant about the things in Scripture, and actually quoted them because originally they were, you know, his inspired word. And so, if you know, take a book that was clearly written as a chronicle, and you know, dismiss it or dilute it by saying, well, I don't know if young earth creation is the way, or if God used evolution. But so I don't know what to do with the first couple of chapters of Genesis. And that brings me to chapter 3. I don't know what to do with chapter 3, because we had just two people, who sinned, and that started the ball rolling. Evolution doesn't explain that, and evolution actually goes against those first chapters. And so I think it's, you know, I think it's important that we have a clear understanding as to what God wrote and why he wrote it and how it is not in conflict with science, if you ask the right question, we can be firm in our faith and firm in our understanding of the Bible and not be intimidated into believing, atheistic scientists that want to bully us and say, you're a fool for believing in young earth creationism.
I think because I'm not good at apologetics, I get intimidated by these conversations, and I probably fall back on, you know, what is my strength, which is more of a childlike faith. I believe it's true because I believe my God knows better than me, and I feel like you can never win in an apologetics argument with someone who is who has all that evolution stuff behind them to argue. And I guess I get very intimidated by those conversations, and I shy away from them.
I can see that, because it's tough to argue with someone with no faith when your argument is based on faith. You're not talking the same language, and it turns out to be an unproductive discussion. But unfortunately, so many have persuaded so many others that you can take the Bible, discard the parts you can't understand, or choose not to believe and accept the other part. No longer is it a unified whole. And yet, if you know the New Testament, you know, there's the old saying that the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed. The New Testament is the Old Testament revealed. Mm-hmm. And Jesus does make so many references to the Old Testament, that gives it credibility. Mm-hmm. And to these clergy who were in the survey and came out kind of in the middle ground someplace, well, theistic evolution, and it might have taken a bazillion years to do there. They're making decisions on the Bible, and they're throwing out some of that as not rational, and therefore not applicable to the argument. And that disturbs me.
It disturbs me. Sorry, Dave.
I mean, that's right. I mean, you know, just a brief point. I mean, they you're not arguing with a person that doesn't have a faith. They just don't have the faith in the same thing you do. They have faith in their own abilities. There was a time in my youthful existence when I thought I knew it all, and I believed I had faith in me, and I was able to answer all the questions. So it wasn't really debating someone else with no faith, but just faith in something else. In this particular case, me or the guy down the street or a PhD or a university somewhere who had a lot of test tubes and all those fancy things like that.
Hmm. Well, and then, of course, you didn't bank on the devolution theory either.
No. I mean, devolution, I don't know what's happened to us.
It's happening to me every day. I don't know.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, it's happening to me by the minute.
Seen some of that, too. Dr. Don Clark, go ahead.
Yeah. I got one more comment, and this is 1 Peter 3:15, which is I think the reason why we have to at least look into some of these questions, and then Peter says, but sanctify the Lord in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. And that's our charge. And so we have to ask God, okay, why do I believe? And when someone asks you, why do you believe? Well, I believe because such and such happens. And of course, our greatest testimony is those things that happen in our life where God clearly intervened and clearly showed himself to us, because it's our personal testimony that helps others to come to see our Lord and Savior as well.
And not only that, but in the process, Don, I think we become stronger by contending for the faith. We learn how to function in that environment. And for example, when you open the Bible and you read something you don't understand and you wrestle with it, that's an opportunity for God or His Spirit to intervene and bring you knowledge, to light things up for you. Whereas if you just didn't care, you closed the book and called it quits, you wouldn't have that opportunity.
And I would go one step further. Even if we don't necessarily understand, in quote, the science behind it, God can still illuminate through the Holy Spirit an understanding that draws our faith, strengthens our faith. Very quickly, my own personal testimony, when I became a Christian, I was one of those scientists that evolution was the way it happened, and I had the evolutionary story down pat. And if you asked me, well, you know, how did we get here, I would have told you the evolutionary story, starting from the Big Bang. But when I became a Christian, I wrestled for months with Genesis. And that was the first commentary that I read as a new Christian, was the Genesis record by Henry Morris. And as I was reading that commentary, lights started to go off and say, of course, that's the only explanation for what we see. But it took faith first. Faith came first, and it was just believing. It was just this, as the Heike you said, it's a childlike faith. We come to God no other way. but as a child. Anyway.
Good point. And Dr. Don Clark, a biochemist and, again, a director with Creation Moments. You can visit their website from ours. If you're listening on Broken Road Radio this morning, there's a link to it on the right-hand side, creationmoments.com. You'll find all kinds of very valuable and interesting resources there, from DVDs to writings, and there's a blog going on, and lots of radio programs. In fact, maybe next hour we'll have Ian Taylor's program, Creation Moments, at about 9:50 Central Time. So, Don, you're such an important part of our morning team. Thanks very much for joining us again today. And we'll let you go go batting down the grapes so that the wind doesn't take them away. Okay.
All right. Yeah, well, we have visitors coming midweek that are going to take a look at our vineyard and decide whether or not they want to buy our grapes.
So, oh, hey, well.
We got to get them in order, which is a big task between now and then.
You got to dust off all those grapes, I guess. Make them, spruce them up just a bit. Don,
well,
thanks.
They're flowering now, so they haven't actually developed into grapes yet.
Love to see a picture. Music continues on a Broken Road Radio Monday morning. These are the Beach Boys. That's Why God Made the Radio.